It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff, here with Jonathan Mayo and Jim Callis. Jonathan and I, sitting side by side in Nashville, Tennessee, home of this year's winter meetings. Jim, I can only imagine, is surrounded by a plethora of golden retrievers back at home. Should I give out your home address, Jim?
Yeah, you gave out my email address. I actually gave out my cell number today. So I can get some holiday wishes number from our listeners. But that's okay.
So yeah, we're here in Nashville, and basically, you know, winter meetings every year, we're looking out for trades, free agent signings that could affect the draft order. We got now the draft lottery, obviously, is a big part of winter meetings for us. And then, as always, the Rule 5 draft. And as we're recording this, we're in between the draft lottery and the Rule 5 draft. So not a lot of Rule 5 draft to talk about. So all of you Rule 5 fans out there, there are so many of you, we know, not a lot here for you, but we're going to talk draft lottery because that just happened. We're fresh off the draft lottery, second year, and some interesting goings on. We'll talk about that. There have been a couple trades, or one and a half, one and three quarters. As we record, there's one that has just been reported, and both have involved prospects, and both have involved former highly ranked prospects. So we'll talk about those. And the recipient of the number one pick in the draft lottery, the Cleveland Guardians, we wasted no time. Jonathan rushed out and grabbed the Guardians senior vice president of scouting, Paul Gillespie. We talked to him. So we'll get to hear from him fresh off of learning that they have the number one pick in next year's draft. And how else could we wrap up? Oh, no, wait. We're going to talk about the Jackson 2. The two
holiday
top
and Trio,
Holiday and Churio. A little bit of news about both of them. Big news about Churio with his gigantic deal, $82 million over 8 years, a couple of club options, could be there for 10 years, and contract could reach $140 million. A lot of money. And then there's talk about Jackson Holliday potentially making the opening day roster. And then no other way to wrap up, really, other than to answer a question from Stevie D. So we'll do that. All right. Jim, you watched the draft lottery from afar. Jonathan, you watched it from
a near.
From a near. Let's get both of your perspectives. Jonathan, up close and personal, what'd you think?
First and foremost, I love the draft lottery. I just think it's a nice wrinkle. It's a lot of fun. I think it creates a lot of buzz about the draft. And I don't even look, I know that they're, you know, the hope is that it's trying to make sure teams keep, you know, competing and things of that nature, but I really look at it mostly just from not a marketing standpoint, but I think it's good for the game. People are very excited about it. It garners a lot of coverage. And, you know, I thought they did a really nice job with the production this year. But more than anything, it shines a light on the draft, and it was a lot of fun. And as you mentioned at the top, the Cleveland Guardians, you know, having a large surprise as the number one pick just sort of adds to the intrigue.
Yeah, it was a good day for Ohio. Watching from afar, watching on TV, I thought the first thing I noticed was I thought the production elements were more striking this year. You know, last year you kind of had these tiny tables and 18 mostly scouting directors kind of sitting at them, not really knowing what they were supposed to do, and a camera in their face. And this year we had podiums and it was better lit and it was on a stage, and you had, I don't know if celebrities is the right word, but you had, you know, notable franchise.
We had a celebrity for sure.
What's that? Well, oh yeah. But Brad Paisley running the thing, like it sets a high bar for Dallas. Like it seemed like more of a TV show this year rather than, hey, let's put these 18 guys in a dark room and a camera and we'll do the draft lottery. And I agree with you, Jonathan. I don't know if I'll say love, maybe because I'm not there firsthand to experience it. I do like the draft lottery because, I mean, it creates interest in the draft, which I think is good. If it wasn't for that, I doubt anybody really be talking about the 2024 baseball draft, you know, in the first week of December. But I do think it creates interest. And I do think in terms of, you know, the winter meetings, having been to several of them, there's a lot more talk compared to action, like actual moves happening. But this is like one of the more interesting things that I think happens at the winter meetings every year now. So I will give it a strong like. I won't go love yet, Jonathan, but I'll give it a strong like.
That was a very get off my lawn kind of endorsement there.
No, not at all. I'm not angry. I'm not looking down at the draft lottery. I just, all right, not in love.
Fair enough. Okay.
Didn't even put a 2080 grade on it.
I'll give it a 60.
Yeah, I'll go 70.
Wow.
I love the lottery, man.
Okay. So, Jim, you mentioned Guardians being the big winners, a big surprise. They had a 2% chance of getting the number one overall pick. The Reds had a 1% chance of getting the number two pick after the Guardians had received the number one pick. 5,000-1 odds that the Guardians and Reds would get the number one and two picks. So we're kind of breaking this segment down into winners and losers based on what happened in the draft lottery. And clearly the two big winners, very obviously the Guardians and the Reds.
Yeah, I mean, it's even in talking to the Guardians, and you'll hear my conversation with Paul Gillespie, they really had no thought that, oh, this could actually happen. Sure, you have to be in it to win it, and there's always a chance, but I think they were not hanging their hopes on getting the number one pick. And then the Reds had, you know, the largest jump of any team. What were they, 13th, I think, in terms of the odds?
Yep, 13 to 2.
Yeah, so they went from 13 to 2. You know, so they, it's a huge benefit for them. So two, you know, it'd be enough of a story if it was just the Guardians at number one, but to have both of the top picks, be that surprising against those kinds of seemingly insurmountable odds is really something. Now I'm sure the, you know, with the A's, Royals, and Rockies aren't thrilled about how that turned out, and you know, we'll talk about some of them, you know, in a bit. But from an excitement standpoint, I think anytime there's that kind of surprise, it adds to the intrigue.
Yeah, it was pretty stunning. You know, and it not only do they get the top two picks, and it's interesting, I think we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but I don't think there's a clear cut number one or two guy. There's some talented players top the draft, but it's not like we know, oh, hey, you know, the Guardians might be taking Dylan Cruz or Wyatt Langford, which is what we probably would have said a year ago at this time. But not only do you move up in the draft and you get better picks, just the financial effect that you get from making jumps like that, just looking at this year's bonus pool numbers, which will go up in proportion to how baseball revenues went up this year. But just using this year's numbers, and the actual amounts will be higher than this when they calculate it, the Guardians added $4 million to their bonus pool by jumping from 9 to 1. And it'll be more than 4 when they make the adjustment. The Reds, from going 13 to 2, added like $4.15 million. I mean, both those teams are going to have much huger budgets to spend on the draft than they would have had otherwise. You know, and you know, the first slot last year, or I mean, in the last draft, was worth $9.7 million. So that's going to go up. Nobody's going to get $9.7 million as number one pick in this draft, at least as we project it right now. So, I mean, the Guardians and the Reds can take the best player and still have a bunch of money they've saved to spend elsewhere in the draft. So, I mean, it's this just helps your draft, not just by moving up, but by giving you so much more spending power than you would have had otherwise.
All right, so Guardians get the first pick, Reds get the second pick. The next two picks go to two of the three teams that were tied for the highest odds of getting the number one overall pick. The Rockies get number three, A's number four, and then the White Sox get the number five pick, and the Royals get the number six pick. The Royals were the third team that had the highest odds of getting the number one overall pick. So the Royals with a bit of a drop there, which I guess probably puts them into our group of, I shouldn't, we're calling them.
They didn't do as well.
We're saying winners and losers. I mean, we're
non-winners. Okay, fine.
That's fine. I mean, much too sensitive here. Control. Jeez.
So, but they are not the biggest losers.
Okay.
Right?
No, I think they are the biggest losers.
Wait, you think the Royals are the biggest losers?
I thought you meant those three teams.
I thought you meant that.
That group was not the biggest losers. I thought you were going to make your point about the Mets being a bigger loser, which I was not agreeing with.
Well, I'm curious who you guys think.
I think the A's are the biggest loser. And yes, here's why.
Yeah, I agree.
2 years in a row, they've had as good of odds as anybody to have the number one pick. And instead, they pick sixth, which is the lowest lottery pick. And because they're a revenue sharing recipient, they can't get a lottery pick for more than 2 years in a row. So they got the worst lottery pick 2 years in a row when the odds were that they should have had, you know, could have had the top pick back-to-back years as much as anybody. And now the A's, I feel comfortable saying the A's are going to be terrible next year. They're going to be awful. They're going to lose 105 or more games, and it doesn't matter because they don't get to pick higher than 10th. So the A's got the lowest. I'm sorry, this year they picked 4th. I misspoke. But, right. But they got, instead of, they had a good chance to get the number one pick both years. Instead, they're going to pick 6 and 4, and now they can't pick higher than 10 next year. So I think the A's are the biggest loser.
And last year when they got the number six pick, it was in the draft that had
five great players.
Right. And then this year they move up two spots in a much murkier top of the first round, at least.
Because to me, I mean, I'll say this. I don't think there's much difference as the draft looks today between picking 4th and 7th. Like if it were me, outside of having the extra money, if I was in a position like the A's or the White Sox, because the White Sox, they're a revenue sharing payor. They can only have a lottery pick 1 year in a row. I would rather, if I was the A's or White Sox, pick 7th right outside the lottery than pick in the lottery, because the White Sox are going to be bad next year too and be banned from picking above 10 next year. I mean, do you guys agree with that? Would you, if you're those teams, would you rather pick 7th this year and keep your lottery possibilities open next year?
Yeah, without question. I mean, to that point, you know, the Royals obviously, you know, had a chance to be one of the top picks, or get the number one pick. That as good a chance as anybody, but at least last year they fell out of the lottery. So you know they were very close to being in the same boat as the A's, but they have another year where they can be involved in the lottery at least. So that makes them, I think, sort of on the second tier of non-winners.
And you know, and just again talking about the financial ramifications, if we take the three teams that all had the highest odds and kind of average it out that they would have the second pick, the A's from dropping to 2 to 4 lose about $2.3 million. The White Sox going from 4 to 5, it's not that much. They lose like $500,000, but they're banned from the lottery now next year. And the Royals going from, you know, we're thinking they're going to pick in the top 3 to 6. That cost them about $2.3 million. And they went backwards last year too. I think they went 5th to 8th, if I'm remembering that correctly. So pretty harsh. Although, again, if I'm the Royals, in a way, I'm almost Well, I shouldn't say. I'd rather pick in the top five last year with the five guys who were on the board. But the right. only silver lining is they're still alive for the lottery next year. It's
right. And you want to be alive for the lottery next year more than you would this year.
Well, right? I mean, at this point, based we think that based because I don't think this year's draft. I think it's kind of fringy right now, but I just think in general, if I'm not picking like one or two, I mean, it depends how many guys are in the draft. I'd rather be alive for the lottery. I'd rather give me the seventh pick and keep me alive for the lottery.
Yeah, I agree with that. With the chance to maybe get Ethan Holiday next year.
Now, another team, we talked about how the A's, White Sox, and Royals were impacted. The Mets had a very interesting situation because they were eligible for the lottery. But they're also getting docked 10 spots because they went over the competitive balance tax threshold by over $40 million. So if they ended up getting a top six pick, their second pick was going to get dropped 10 spots. Those first six picks are protected. But when they didn't, and they had like a nearly 50% chance of getting one of those six picks, when they didn't, that dropped them all the way down to 19. So basically a flip of a coin between getting a top six pick and then picking number 19, and that's where they end up.
You think Kumar Rocker was like pumping his fist if he was watching the draft lottery when he saw that?
That's not nice.
Well, they weren't nice to him when they didn't sign him. I mean, Steve Cohen kind of –
if he
stuck
was,
the knife in him, as they didn't sign him. So I'll say this. I have a philosophical question for you, not specifically with the Mets. To me, you know, if you're trying to restrict teams from, you know, spending wildly, you know, which is why you have this penalty in place, you drop 10 spots. Why shouldn't it apply even if you have a lottery pick? That rule doesn't make sense to me the way they apply it. Like, If the Mets, you know, they went way over the lottery, the luxury tax threshold, they had a bad season, too bad. You should drop 10. Like, having your second pick move down 10 spots isn't really much of a deterrent at all. I mean, nobody asked me to write the CBA. But
no, you get penalized more if you spend a lot of money.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, philosophically, you should, if the rule is your pick drops 10 spots, I'm fine. Mets get the number one pick. They pick 11.
No, at the very least, I think if you go past that threshold, maybe you should be ineligible for the
lottery. Yeah, it just seems odd to me that, like, you could spend wildly, have a disappointing year, and we're going to penalize you. But, hey, if you get the number one pick, we're not really going to penalize you.
Right. Like, see, this way, if you're ineligible for the draft and you have a really bad year, then maybe you still pick seventh, right? So you get a chance to kind of reboot because things haven't gone well, but you're not being given the ability to pick.
I'm dropping, you know, 10 out. Spots from seven. I'm making him ineligible for the lottery and dropping him 10. Or
and dropping
put him or spots. Put okay. him in the lottery, and if all they right, win, commish. They just drop 10. Like,
All right.
That is what happened in the draft lottery. Oh, what else should we the Yankees and the Padres also were eligible for the lottery, but did not get a top six pick. So their first picks also dropped 10 spots, which puts them at 25 and 26. We learn more about the draft order, not just the first round, but we found out now what the competitive balance round picks look like, and those look like this: competitive balance round A. Well, first of all, there are a few picks in between the first round and competitive balance round A. You have at 31 and 32 your prospect promotion incentive picks. We talked about this last week, I believe. D-backs pick at 31, Orioles at 32, because Corbin Carroll and Gunnar Henderson won Rookie of the Year after being on the opening day roster for those teams. And then the Twins have garnered a compensation pick when the Cardinals signed Sonny Gray. So they're picking currently at 33. And then we have our competitive balance round A. It goes like this: Baltimore, Arizona, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Colorado, and Kansas City. And then your competitive balance round B picks, which come after the second round. So these as it stands now, are picks 69 through 76. Tampa Bay, Milwaukee, Seattle, Minnesota, Miami, Cincinnati, Detroit, and Oakland. And guys, what I find most interesting about this is going back to competitive balance round A, where you have the Orioles and the D-backs and the Guardians. So you have two teams that were very good this year in the Orioles and the D-backs, who also have those prospect promotion incentive picks. They're also picking, you know, toward the back end of the first round.
Right. Was it three picks in the top 35 for both of them?
Yeah. I mean, and these are really good teams already who are going to be able to potentially load up. I mean, and Jim, you talked about the money being as much of a factor as the picks themselves, but guys, these two teams are looking good here for next year's draft.
Yeah, I mean, those prospect promotion picks are going to be worth about $3 million in bonus pool money to each of those teams. I have a question, and I honestly don't know the answer to this. Jonathan, I've dubbed you many years ago the czar of the competitive balance round. So I'm asking you this question. How do they determine what order those picks are in? It's not based on one loss record, obviously.
No, there is a formula.
There's a formula that takes into account a combination of
market size.
It's a complicated formula that we aren't privy to the entirety of it.
Because it seems like they could just say
It's revenue winning percentage and market score. For teams that fall in the bottom 10 in revenue or market size. So, and it changes, yeah. Right? So 2 years ago, there were 15 teams. And then last year, there were 14. This coming, you know, for the 2024 draft, it'll be the same 14 teams. And basically, the teams that picked in comp round B now pick in A,
right,
and vice versa in a slightly different order based on this formula.
So are you rewarded for a good winning percentage or are you rewarded for a bad winning percentage?
I would imagine bad winning percentage.
I don't know. I'm glad I'm not the only one who doesn't know exactly. And like, it feels like you could just say, hey, we have this really complicated formula and then just be hanging out in the back office. We'll give Orioles 34, D-backs 35.
we're going to go into the office and there's like a dartboard.
Yeah.
That's the complicated formula.
Yeah. A's have been difficult this year. Just give them pick 76. They can pick at the end of round B. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I was curious. Sorry for distracting us, taking us off.
I mean, it's relevant. It's okay.
Yeah. So the draft order is more or less set, with the exception of we still have some free agents who were offered qualifying offers and rejected them, and now if they sign, when they sign with another team, if and when they sign with another team, there will be comp picks attached to those. But more or less, we now know the draft order. You can go to MLB.com/draft and check out the full draft order there. And leading things off next year will be the Cleveland Guardians. And we had a chance to talk. Jonathan had a chance to talk to their vice president of scouting, Paul Gillespie. We're going to listen to that when we come back right after this on the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Jonathan Mayo here, still in Nashville. The second annual draft lottery has just been completed, and the Cleveland Guardians, with a 2% chance of getting the number one overall pick, got the number one overall pick. And here to join us on the pod right now is their senior vice president of scouting, Paul Gillespie. Paul, thank you so much.
Hey, Jonathan, thank you so much for having me, man. Super exciting time. When we woke up this morning, probably didn't think we'd be in this position, but it's 2% chance. Holy cow! But it's awesome. We're super excited.
My understanding is that when you guys were informed, there was like sort of a shock. You guys were almost joking about like, all right, we have a chance, but do we really have a chance?
Exactly. There was definitely a great deal of shock value. We were all kind of watching it together in the suite, and when we kind of, you kind of start reading the tea leaves, and it got really loud really quickly.
Yeah, are you a fist bump kind of guy, a high five kind of guy? Like, what was your initial reaction?
I'm a high five and like hug kind of guy.
No, I think that's fair. I grew up in the New York area, and I remember when they had the NBA draft lottery, and the Knicks got Patrick Ewing. Well, they got the lottery to get Patrick Ewing, and Dave DeBuscher, who was former Knick.
Yep.
Like, I think that cemented lottery as good TV, because everyone is all these very stoic executives, and he just gave this huge fist bump because he was so excited for getting the number one pick.
Man. Yeah, a lot of fist bumping going on.
Right, right. It's kind of crazy that this will be the first time the organization has ever had the number one pick. I mean, it's a great opportunity, but that's kind of a lot of pressure too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, anytime you have the number one overall pick, I mean, I think it definitely brings a level of maybe a little anxiety, right? But at the same time, but more than that, probably a level of excitement to the organization. I mean, we get to pick first overall. The way we do our draft and the way we get to know players, it is such a organizational effort. And so super excited for the people that are going to be digging in on these players over the next 8 months.
It's been a while since you've picked anywhere near the top, really. How much different is it? And maybe that's something you're going to have to sort of figure out. But, compared to when, I feel like you're always picking in like the late teens or the 20s.
Right.
And obviously you want to pick lower. But how does it change how you bring what you do for the draft into making that decision at the top?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, when you're picking where we picked, like you were saying, these last decade, fortunately that means your team, your major league team, is probably done pretty well. So that's a good thing. But this is a little bit of a game changer in that way. I think from a strategic standpoint, I don't think we're going to do anything different necessarily, other than try to get to know these players as best as we possibly can. Like I mentioned, organizationally, we do a lot to get to know the players, not only on the field, but off the field. And I think, when you have a little bit more opportunity, when you pick so high, I'm sure we'll want to think about exactly how we think about the players that we're on and things like that, how we're spending our time. But in terms of strategy, it's get the best player.
Wow. And at least you won't have anyone who can pick your pocket right ahead of you or things like that. So you can decide who the best guy is, and you are guaranteed to get him if you want him.
That's right. And I think that's, when you think about what our approach we're going to be, I don't think anything's going to change, right? Like, yes, we do have the number one pick, and that's super exciting. But we're just trying to take the best players that we possibly can. The draft is, at this point, it's 8 months away. So we're going to spend all of our time trying to get to know all the players as best as we possibly can. So when it's our turn to pick, we're ready.
Right. So people understand, it's not, you probably have your follow lists from the summer and things like that. And it's not like that changes dramatically. Your follow list is still going to be the same at this point
whether you pick one or 29 or wherever it is. It's not until later that you start trying to figure out who might be there for you, right? So I would imagine that right now it's still status quo, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a great point. I think you said it perfectly. Right now, we're still trying to get to know the class, right? And that starts really while the prior year's draft is kind of going on, right? Our scouts start the process for that next year's draft, kind of when the current draft that we're on is in process. So, you know, and so if you think about it that way, we're still in the early stages of getting to know the class and getting a good understanding of them as players and as people. But we got a lot of work ahead of us. And again, just picking first, that brings an additional level of excitement.
Obviously, no one's decided who you're taking yet. I tried to ask you before we started recording. So good for you for not giving it up right away. But it's way too early for that. But I think it's sort of interesting. I think looking at what you guys have done in the draft, you know, there's been a proclivity for guys who really can hit, college hitters, you know, in early rounds anyway, right? And at least as of right now, the top players in this class all kind of fit into that bucket of the kind of player you already like. I don't know if you've gotten your head around the, you know, how that Venn diagram might match up, but I mean, is it exciting to you that this seems to be a class that the strength is a group that you guys tend to kind of lean towards more often than not?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially at this part of the year and this part of calendar, I think we want to stay super open-minded about who can be there. I mean, you never know what can happen. You know, players will, you know, improve their stock. You know, some players, you know, they can start to, you know, their stock and, you know, slide. I mean, because again, we're 8 months away, so we don't exactly know what's going to happen. But I think the best thing that we can do right now is stay completely open-minded, completely unbiased about who could be there, and just focus on the scouting process, and then let the decision process kind of take care of itself when we get to that point.
What are your thoughts? Let's put aside the fact that you just won the thing, but just in general, like your thoughts on the draft lottery, just as a concept. I kind of see it as something that's brought like a lot more excitement to baseball and the draft in particular, and that's always been something that I've cared about. I think it's great. I'm curious from your maybe front office standpoint, I'm sure it's nerve-wracking, but like what do you think of having this be a part of the annual draft process?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, In general, I think it brings another level of excitement to our game. You know, I mean, waking up and coming into the day, we had a 2% chance to be the first pick, and wow, we got it. So I think in general, I think, you know, of course we did not have the year at the major league level that we would have liked, right? You know, thankfully we've been able to have some sustained success here, and I think that's been great. But you know, 2% chance, and then but you actually, again, didn't have the year we wanted, but we have the first pick. That's really cool.
I mean, don't gloat too much. You know, the A's, Rockies, Royals, you know, with their 18% chance, are not too happy with you right now. So like, you don't want to shove that 2% in their faces too much, I don't think.
No, absolutely not. And all those clubs, they do a phenomenal job. You know, but it's just, you know, when you try to wrap your head around it, it's like, wow. You know, like you said, we've never had the first pick. I think the last time we picked in the top five, I think, was 2013, maybe.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So it's been a while. You know,
you picked number two like five times, but you hadn't done that since like 1992.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, I think most people, when they think Cleveland and like top of the draft, they tend to think Francisco Lindor. I think he's the guy who you hope to find that kind of impact player. I mean, totally. Throughout the draft, but especially when you're picking in the top of the fridge, you talk about the excitement and the pressure that comes with it, right? The hope is that you don't just get a good player, you get a guy who can help change a franchise direction.
Totally. I mean, again, you know, when you're picking that high, you know, in theory, like, those are, you know, the better players, right? Or the players that are toward the top of the draft. So it is an exciting time. At the same time, I think one of the things we take pride in organizationally is just trying to find value all throughout the draft. So, yeah, we do have the first pick, but that's not going to change our approach in trying to make every selection count.
Sure. I mean, right now the excitement is over the top pick because of what just transpired with the, with the lottery. But, yes, 20 rounds, there's a lot of talent to be had and players all up and down. So we, I think we know that. Our listeners probably know that too. So we can talk about the other 19 rounds another time. But so you were saying you've been with Cleveland for 17 years, is that what you said?
Yes. All right. I started and right around now, so November 2006, I started my internship with Cleveland, and somehow have been here ever since.
Yeah. So and you've done international scouting, you've done domestic scouting, and now you're in this, this sort of in the director's chair, so to speak. I'm curious from your vantage point, like even from the time that you started as an intern, the draft has changed. Obviously, the rules have changed. The interest in the draft continues to rise. Like, from your vantage point, what has your take been just on sort of how everything has changed to the point where we have a half-hour national TV show to find out who has the number one pick?
Yeah, I think you just said it right. I mean, it's the amount of excitement over the years that the draft, you know, everybody loves the draft, right? It's just a thing that, you know, no matter what organization you're in, I think, you know, front offices, scouts, they really just enjoy sort of like, you know, the chase, the uncertainty that the draft brings, but just seeing how the process has evolved over the years, I think it's great for the game, and it's exciting, and we have this opportunity in front of us. You know, we don't want to deviate, you know, away from what we do, which is try to get to know players really, really well and try to take the best ones that we can.
I'm sure, like, listen, even if the lottery hadn't gone your way, you were going to be picking decently high. You knew you had a great opportunity here. But how fired up are you just to get going? Like, you sound like if you could go see a game tomorrow, you would be ready. You'd be like, you're checking Oregon State and West Virginia and all these other, you know, teams that have some of the guys that are being mentioned as the top guy, but I bet you, like, you're chomping at the bit already, aren't you?
Oh, we certainly are. And I mean, it's funny because of, like you said, the lottery was tonight. We found out kind of where, you know, where we're picking and those types of things. At the same time, and you know this very well too, our scouts have been working on, you know, the 2024 draft class for quite a while now, right? So while it is a special day, right, the lottery, you kind of find out where you pick at the same time, the work has been going on, and that's really where you make the difference in our scouts, their ability to know the players, know the class, and put us in position to make decisions, and they do a great job at that.
All right, last question. You know, we talk a lot of times about how the guy who goes number one has a kind of spotlight on him to see how he does. You know, the spotlight's going to be, like, on you and on Chris. Right? Everyone's going to be watching to see where you're, like, oh, here he is. Do you have some good disguises picked out so people don't realize that you're going to see a certain guy?
Yeah, I hadn't necessarily thought about that.
I'm here for you.
Maybe I should think about that. But I think organizationally, you know, this is going to be such a team effort. Such an organizational effort. There's so many people from many different departments that spend a lot of time on the draft digging into players. So there's no one person or two people that are gonna drive this thing. It is such an organizational lift, and I think it's the way we're able to collaborate as a group. I think it's just a special time, and I think it's a really a good team bonding and team building experience too. So this is just going to add a little level of additional excitement to that.
I can recommend some hat and glass combination. we'll get into another time. But Paul, thank you so much for taking some time. I'll let you get back to your group and maybe continue to celebrate the lottery win. And
a few more fist bumps coming tonight.
There you go.
Sure.
And we'll be watching to see where you're on the road as the spring transpires. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
That's Paul Gillespie from the Cleveland Guardians, and we'll be right back with more of the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ralph here with Tim Callis and Jonathan Mayo. We've been talking a lot about the draft lottery and the draft order. Other things going on here at the winter meetings. A big signing. Jackson Churio. He was here in Nashville. They made it official. This deal seemed to kind of linger on for a while. We heard about it like a week ago, I feel like. 8 years, $82 million. Club options for, I keep wanting to say like 2023 and 24. We're talking into the 2030s for guys.
Yeah, those aren't real years.
Yeah. Potential to earn up to, I believe, something around $140 million. Largest contract ever for a player with zero big league experience, 19 years old, skyrocketed up our rankings over the past year or so. A lot of comparisons to someone else who made a giant leap up our rankings and then became a superstar in Acuna. What do you guys think? Fair comparison?
I mean, let's let him play an inning in the big leagues.
Oh, come on. You spend your whole life writing about these guys.
Exactly.
And projecting and putting grades on them and casting judgment.
Suddenly you're Mr. Comp?
No, I'm not come saying on. Comp, but I'm saying you can talk whether he's in the same echelon.
The question was literally, do you think that's a fair comparison?
I didn't look at it as like a straight comp, like can he be that good of a player?
You didn't listen to the question.
No, I did. I just interpreted the question in a different fashion. Like Jonathan can be Mr. Sensitive again. He's in love with the draft lottery. He's just in love. But yeah, no, I think he's that type of talent. He's a potential transcendent talent who has unbelievable tools at a young age and has accomplished a lot and got off to a slow start last year when they were using the pre-tac ball and then looked like the Jackson Churio of old, but you can't call Jackson Churio old. No, I mean, it's one of these deals too, where if he's as good as he's supposed to be, the Brewers probably save a lot of money, but at the same time, like I'd have a hard time turning down $80 million at age 19 or age 20. It's just a deal that makes a lot of sense for both sides. They both took a risk, but they both got some certainty too. And I think it's smart. I mean, the Brewers are not a large revenue franchise, and this ensures that Jackson Churio is probably going to be there for, if he's as good as we think he is, at least 10 years. And I think that's really positive. So I know there's, you know, you hear some from some agents, they don't like these types of deals, but I can see why the Brewers would give it to him, and I could see why he would take it.
You know, I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think the Brewers sort of, not even hedge their bets, but like there's a little protection because of the options, you know, that they didn't like go all in and give him $140 million over 10 years before he played. Like some of it's a little incentive based, right? So those will kick in, assuming, you know, he's as good as it seems like he's going to be. And all joking aside about comps, I mean, he has every chance to be an incredibly exciting, dynamic, and special player in the big leagues. And we're going to find that out, you know, sooner rather than later. But I do think that, I agree with you, Jim, that it kind of works well for both sides, you know, at least on paper.
Does he open the season in the big leagues because of this?
Sounds like it. I mean,
yeah, I mean, he's got to be given every chance to. You know, the outfield is a little crowded in Milwaukee. You don't block Jackson Churio with anybody, but you know, they do have some big league outfield depth. You know, Christian Yelich and Sal Frelick and Garrett Mitchell and Joey Weimer. Right, we were talking about this the other day, and so there's some personnel there, but none of them are going to get in the way of Jackson Churio playing in the big leagues. But you know, they'll have to sort of decide how that's going to work in terms of the other outfielders and where they're going to play and how they're going to get at-bats.
So we could see the top two prospects in baseball, both named Jackson Churio and Jackson Holliday, on opening day rosters. There's some talk right now about Jackson Holliday being given every chance to make that opening day roster. And we talked about this throughout the year. And I think at some point over the course of the year on the podcast here, you guys put odds on it. And what are you thinking now? I guess we can go with a simple yes or no. Does Jackson Holliday make the Orioles opening day roster? Jim?
No.
Jonathan?
Yes.
All right, moving right along.
I'll be contrary. I don't think so. I honestly don't think so. I hate to agree with Jim.
I know you do.
They've got so much depth. Now, I think the one thing that could change the dynamic is if they make a trade for, say, a Dylan Cease or another starting pitcher, something along those lines, and they trade some of that infield depth away, then I think you could see it happening. And I think, like, I mean, Jim, what happens if he goes in and is just unbelievable throughout spring training? Do you think that changes things at all? But I really think personnel would have to be shifted for some of that starting pitching that they need for there to really be room. Otherwise, there's not a real good reason other than one of those PPI picks.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much does that factor into the equation?
It factors a ton, honestly, because I think the Orioles are 100% in win now mode, and they're going to have the team, the players who are best equipped to help them win, rather than, because, like, look, I love Jackson Holliday as a player. But, like, just because he makes your opening roster doesn't mean he's going to have a rookie of the year caliber season. It's not like that's a given. You know, it's not always as easy as it was this year when the top two prospects in baseball were Gunnar Henderson and Corbin Carroll, and then they're the rookies of the year. Maybe the Jacksons will be rookies of the year next year. But I just, like, I agree with what Jonathan said. They have so much infield depth right now, and as talented as he is, he's played 18 games above AA. And he was fine in AAA, but he didn't tear it up. I don't see any need to rush him. And I feel like they'd be rushing him a little bit. I think you let him play, you know, let him play a month in AAA, see what the big league team looks like, you know, see what he looks like and go from there. If it were me, yes, I'd love to get the PPI pick, but I wouldn't force it. And in this case, it wouldn't be a consideration for me.
Okay. So talking about the Jacksons there, let's talk about some trades now. We started off the winter meetings on Sunday night. There was a trade, and it only involved one current prospect, Cole Phillips, who has not even pitched a professional inning yet, but he's the only ranked prospect in this deal, but it did include some former very highly ranked prospects. Jared Kelnick, Marco Gonzalez, Evan White traded from Seattle to Atlanta for Jackson Kaur and Cole Phillips. So we have 1, 2, 3 former top 100 prospects.
And 4 former first round picks, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so an interesting trade here. What were your impressions of this?
Well, my first impression was, really, this has to go down as I'm landing in Nashville. and then, you know, because the first thing you hear is 5-player deal, and the Braves and Mariners are both my team, so I panicked. There was only the one actual prospect in Cole Phillips who, and I'll start there, is interesting because he had first-round arm and then had Tommy John surgery, but got paid, you know, got drafted and signed anyway, and he's yet to throw a professional pitch. So we don't really know what Cole Phillips is going to be. The Mariners will try to figure that out in 2024, but he has, you know, the stuff to be a starting pitcher, I think. But let's let him get going first before we pronounce anything. I put him in, you know, somewhere right in the middle of the current Mariners top 30, just because he's such a big question mark. And then, you know, the other guys are all, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of former top prospects. And I think that for the Braves, for this to work, Jared Kelnick is going to end up being one of their starting outfielders. And the glimpses that he started to show last year, I think he'll do long-term. Marco Gonzalez could pitch in the back end of their rotation possibly. And then who knows with Evan White? I mean, he's had so many injuries. He had hip surgery. You know, he hasn't played in the big leagues in 2 years after signing, a big contract as a prospect, relatively big. That's a little bit of a wild card there. You know, I don't really totally get this trade in either direction. The Mariners trying to sort of shed some salary. Maybe Jackson Kaur, who ended up with the Braves but never pitched for him because he got acquired during the offseason. It'd be fun to have a Jackson Kaur Braves jersey. It would be like one of those deals because he never actually played for them. But maybe he can help out of their bullpen. They can sort of tease some of that stuff back out. But it was a little bit of a curious trade. And I think, you know, we're not going to know for a while until we see Cole Phillips over a longer period of time what he, you know, what he actually is and what that does in terms of, you know, who quote unquote won this trade.
Yeah, I mean, Phillips was the number 7 prospect on the Braves list. He had some helium prior to the Tommy John surgery. He's like a triple digit throwing right-hander.
Yeah, he was in my neck of the draft, and there was talk he was going to be the first Texas high school pitcher to go in the first round since Grayson Rodriguez, and his velocity made a big jump and he hit triple digits, and then he blew out in April, I want to say, of 2022. But fortunately for him, he had pitched enough and been scouted and cross-checked enough that, you know, the Braves took him in the second round, and, you know, he was going to still go pretty good and get paid because teams had enough time to do work on him before he actually blew out.
Funny that we're talking about Evan White here, because we're talking about the Churio deal earlier, and, you know, biggest deal ever for a player who hasn't had any big league time. I was thinking at the time when we were talking about that, you know, some of those type of deals have worked out well, and others simply have not. And, you know, Evan White's one of those that has not. Scott Kingery, one has not. Ozzie Albies worked out pretty well.
And how about the fact that you remember the whole controversy when Kelnick would not sign one of those deals when the Mariners were trying to lean on him to sign one before they'd promote him?
That's right.
And, you know, they probably are glad they didn't do that deal now, or they're glad that he turned them down.
Another trade that when we just, you know, a half hour ago when we mentioned it, said it was a, we said we had a trade and a half or a trade and three quarters. Now we have fully two trades because it is now official just in the time that we've been recording here. A rare Yankees-Red Sox trade. The Yankees acquiring Alex Verdugo, another former top 100 prospect, for Richard Fitz, Greg Weissert, and Nicholas Judas, a 2023 draft pick. And this one is obviously fresh, but Jim, these are two of your teams.
Yep.
First impressions here.
It seemed like the Red Sox were determined to trade Alex Verdugo, and I think it's a decent prospect haul for him. I'm probably a little lower on Alex Verdugo. I don't know if you guys are big Alex Verdugo fans. I just think he's like a corner outfielder who, you know, last 3 years, 777, 732, 740 ops, despite playing in Fenway Park, which is a great place to hit. Kind of a lackadaisical defensive player. I don't know. I look at him and I see more of an underachiever. I'm not a big Alex Verdugo fan. And like, prospects aren't sure things. These aren't top 100 prospects, but they're interesting. I mean, Weissert's an older, you know, he's 28 years old. He's just graduated to the big leagues in this last year. He's a sinker slider, or you should call him a sinker sweeper reliever. He's okay. He had some interesting numbers in the minors. He hasn't been much in the big leagues, but Fitz and Judas are both kind of interesting. You know, Fitz, you know, classic Yankees who have this gift for taking pitchers in the middle around the draft and extracting value out of them. Fitz was a sixth round pick back in 2021. He went into the year as a potential first round pick, injured his foot, barely pitched. Yankees got him, got healthy, and he's looked pretty good. He's got a four-seam fastball with a lot of cut and ride on it and deuce vertical break. So it's a fastball with a lot of good metrics to it. It's plus fastball. The slider can be plus at times. It's the sweeper that the Yankees like. He can make it into more of a harder, shorter cutter as well. His changeup. I think it could be an average pitch. It's got some fade to it. And I mean, he had a great year last year. Pitched the whole year in AA, struck out 163 guys, 152 and two thirds innings. So, I mean, I think he's a guy who could, you know, maybe be a number four starter. So he's kind of interesting. And then, you know, Judas was a interesting guy in this year's draft. Again, from my neck of the draft, Louisiana Monroe, eighth round pick. But I liked him more than eighth round pick. We ranked him 175 on the draft top 250. 6'8", 230 pounds. Velocity finally ticked up. He's always, you know, been considered pretty projectable. 91 to 95, touched 100 during the spring. Opened the year in the bullpen. They put him in the rotation. His velocity actually went up at the end of the year when he started. You know, with that size, you get angle, you get extension, your pitches get on hitters quickly. He's got a solid slider that's got some, you know, horizontal and vertical action to it. His changeup isn't as far along. I think he's probably a reliever. He'd pitched a lot this spring, so the Yankees didn't have him make his pro debut. But, you know, he'll probably get some innings as a starter and see how the changeup looks. But, yeah, I mean, it seemed like the Red Sox were – Verdugo was not really in their long-term plans. It's a year away from free agency. I think he kind of frustrated the Red Sox, leaving them wanted more. And they got, you know, Weissert will have a chance to make their bullpen, and they got two interesting pitching prospects. I have not yet contemplated where Richard Fitz, who was 12th on the Yankees list, will go on the Red Sox list. The Red Sox have one of the weakest collections of pitching prospects in baseball, so it helps in that regard. I'm just doing this on the off top of my head. He'll probably go in a similar spot on the Red Sox list. Like if we were redoing the list from scratch, I think he'd fall in the 6 to 10 range. He's probably going to be 10th or 11th on the list when we update it as soon as we get the chance.
Jim, I'm reading into this quite a bit here, but I think you must have been excited by Judas. I'm reading your blurb on him on the top
for the first time, right? Or did you read it?
I'm sure I've read it at some point, okay. But you referred to his changeup as his cameo. So I think you were feeling frisky when you.
I'll give you a peek behind the curtain on that. If I don't like using the same word twice in the same sentence, so since I'd already used change up earlier in the sentence, that's why I went with Cambio in second reference. So there was no friskiness there about the change up. I was just trying to not bore the reader by using change up twice in a span of 12 words.
All right. Thank you for that. All right. Let's answer a question from the mailbag here. It comes from our old friend Stevie D at Stevie D Ales 97 on Twitter. Says, if you had to choose the top three picks based on best fit, then who do you see the Guardians, Reds, and Rockies taking? I mean, Stevie D is all over it. The draft lottery just happened.
The ink hadn't even dried.
And he's already wanting to know who these teams are going to take. And you guys did not a mock, but you guys a few weeks ago on the podcast, you guys made
we drafted for fun. We drafted players for fun.
We drafted for
fun. I will say this, right? As it seems right now, the draft class strength is college hitters. And I think both the Guardians and Reds have shown a penchant for taking that kind of hitter. So if I had to guess, that will be the barring something, somebody separating themselves that we're not thinking of, I do think that the top two picks will be some combination of the three guys that we had in our story, which is J.J. Weatherholt from West Virginia, Nick Kurtz from Wake Forest, and Travis Bazana from Oregon State. So I would say if I were going to mock it right now, Jim, I would go Weatherholt 1 to Cleveland and Kurtz 2 to Wake Forest, which is sort of how we had it. And then as much as I love Travis Bazana, and he certainly could figure in, my prediction is that Chase Burns is going to pitch well enough, and we all know the Rockies need pitching and are always looking for it, that Chase Burns would be 3 to the Rockies.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with you on all three picks. I agree with your general sentiment.
Nice.
But I think, and I know Stevie D's asking a question, you're not going to necessarily draft for fit, but if you were at the top of the draft, what do the Guardians need more than anything else? Their starting outfield had only a few more home runs than you, me, and Jason last year. That Quan, Straw, Brennan outfield only had a few more homers than we did. They need power.
So you have Kurtz going.
So I have Nick Kurtz. Okay. If we're going for fit, I think they need Nick Kurtz. And I know Kyle Manzardo's on the way, but you have a DH. You can stick somebody in left field. Those three guys combined for only 11 homers more than we did. And Miles Straw slugged 297. So I think if you're going for fit, they should take Nick Kurtz. For the Reds, and the funny thing is, I think you look at all the position players on the Reds, they could really use a pitcher. I don't think there's a pitcher to take at number two. So I think they're just taking the best available player. So for me, that would be J.J. Weatherholt right now as we go into the new year.
Okay.
And then three for the Rockies. And I'm not being a homer here. I wonder if I could say I'm going to be a little bold here. I think Charlie Condon is going to pass Jack Caglianone among SEC sluggers. As the season progresses, he's got more versatility to him as a position player. He doesn't pitch like Caglianone can, but I think he can play a very competent corner outfield. So I think Charlie Condon of Georgia could sneak into that number three spot. I feel like I've led us slightly astray on Chase Burns, who's talent, like he throws hard as hell, but as we continue to get feedback on the draft, a lot that he's got to prove he can he can throw strikes and command his fastball. I don't think Chase Burns is going to be a top three pick, and I don't think he's going to be the top pitcher taking us. Top pitcher might be Hagen Smith. The pitching's murky, but so anyway, that's my rambling. I will disagree with all your picks, Jonathan. So,
dang,
Stevie D, thanks as always.
Always provocative questions.
always. It never fails. Never fails. We can't pick his questions every week, but we could. Thanks to Stevie D, and thanks also to Guardians Vice President of Scouting Paul Gillespie for joining us. And on short notice and right off of learning that this team had the number one overall pick, thanks to him. And thanks everybody for listening. That is going to do it for this week's episode of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks again, everybody. See you next week.